And if you're looking for a slightly less pricey way to enjoy Music Among the Stars, try this, Star Wars in concert. The space opera spawned 6 movies, an animated series, and an army of costume followers. Are you ready for a chorus and symphony? NPR's Allison Keyes reports.
This is Nerd Heaven.
It's like the Star Wars movies, but cooler, because the stars here are the 85-member symphony orchestra and the 64 choir that really bring this story to life. There's a 3-story high movie screen in this touring show that showcases shots of the orchestra simultaneously with a specially edited montage of music and scenes from all 6 movies.
Luke, I don't want to lose you to the Emperor the way I lost Vader.
You won't.
Star Wars in Concert includes a spectacular light show with flashing emerald green lasers dancing overhead and... some familiar voices.
Even if he is part of a rebel alliance and a traitor, I give you Mr. Anthony Daniels.
C-3PO? I mean Daniels, such a diva.
Thank you. Thank you. And welcome. Welcome to Star Wars in Concert.
Daniels, the live narrator here, played C-3PO in all 6 Star Wars films and in the animated series.
R2-D2, a pleasure to meet you. I am C-3PO.
He says there's the reason the Star Wars saga resonates with this multi-generational audience.
For most people, Star Wars is a timeline of their existence on this planet for the last 35 years. And the story, as I tell it, is of the destiny of Anakin Skywalker, the destiny of 3PO, but it's also the destiny of the audience.
I'm an 80s child, so Star Wars was the seminal movie for us.
Koye Oyedeji brought his 5-year-old son and his father-in-law to see the concert, along with the exhibit of memorabilia that's traveling with the show.
The battle of good versus evil, the idea of the Force. These are things that remain with you throughout your entire life.
Of course, for some folk, it is their life.
My Jedi name is Avlan Koff.
Dave Kofalici rode the Metro here in full Jedi attire. He was 7 when the first movie came out in 1977, and he's been hooked ever since.
I have a lightsaber, the park saber, and the costume itself, I had somebody make it for me. And the belt, these are food capsules and my utility pouches.
Fran Aslam, in the hall taking pictures of her 3 kids with a guy in a really detailed Darth Vader suit, had to think about why the movies touched her.
I guess just the possibility that maybe it could be like that one day. Superheroes, good over evil.
Speaking of evil. The real Darth Vader's here, or at least his costume from the original movie is.
This is a stunt cape?
That's Dave Iskra, exhibit curator, and yeah, he did say stunt cape.
The cape is shorter, so for when he's running.
There's also a Yoda in a glass case, the actual 7-foot-tall Chewbacca costume, which is made of yak fur that has to be brushed daily, and the original model of Han Solo encased in carbonite. But it's the live music that blows the audience away. Lucas Richman conducts John Williams' score and says he and the musicians have great respect for something that's touched millions.
When our horn player plays the horn solo, it conjures up that feeling, that emotional connection. This is really that moment. I remember that moment in the movie, and I'm playing that. That's one of the coolest things.
The other cool thing is seeing classical musicians being treated like rock stars. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
You can hear more of Star Wars in Concert at our website, npr.org.
Each star in our universe is a giant, ferocious ball of gas, kind of like a radio host, burning up fuel, churning together elements, and letting off torrential waves of heat and light. Now take the heaviest of the stars that we had on record as of last week, double its poundage. What you'd have is the new heavyweight champion of stars R136A1. The researchers who released their findings this week say it's about 165,000 light-years away. It burns with 10 million times the brightness of the sun and it could scale in at nearly 320 times the mass of our own sun. Michael Char is the curator of astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and he joins us from the Radio Foundation. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Char.
Absolutely my pleasure.
So, like, what's it like if we could get close?
Very unpleasant. If you stuck such an object in the middle of the solar system, replaced the sun with it, it would practically reach the Earth, and we would roast away both our atmosphere, our ocean, and the top of the continents in a matter of minutes. And we'd certainly be gone, too.
Well, it's as I understand it, the most massive star, but not the biggest.
We don't really have a direct measurement of the size. We can deduce what it almost certainly is. And yes, there certainly are bigger stars in the universe, which are much more puffed up. But in terms of the mass, this does appear to be the all-time record holder.
Now, I'm guessing an object this enormous is something you've had. I mean, you didn't just notice it last week.
No, this object has been in catalogs for better part of a century.
It's you mean part like L.L. Bean? Or?
You're right.
In
astronomical catalogs where we compile either bright stars or planetary nebulae or asteroids or whatever. And the original registration was R136, the 136th object in a particular catalog. So we've known that there was something extraordinary there, and that's what the claim is now, that this is a single unresolved supermassive star.
You know, it's possible, Mr. Char, that our children one day we'll have children who are named things like R136A1.
But, boy, I hope not.
But I mean, why not put a name on this?
We do use the catalog numbers, partly because it refers back to the original catalog. And once you go back to the original catalog, you can find all the literature that refers to it. So naming it John's Star or Betty's Bright Object would take that away from us.
Mr. Shara, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Michael Char, curator of astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History.
You're a shining star, no matter who you are. Shining bright to see, what you can truly be, what you can truly be.
This is NPR News. Scandal, drug testing, cries of cheating, must be time for sports. Alex Rodriguez stands on the verge of joining the exclusive 600 Home Run Club. Is that a juicy accomplishment or a juiced one? And will drug testing in minor league baseball cure major league headaches? Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN the Magazine join us. Morning, Howard.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I think somebody else is trying to reach you on your other line. Tell them to hold on, okay, if they're listening. Listen, A-Rod has 599 home runs. When he hits 600... is he going to stand with the likes of Aaron, Ruth, Mays, and Junior Griffey, or with Bonds and Sosa?
Well, it's obviously going to be with Bonds and Sosa because he's already admitted using performance-enhancing drugs, and it's the numbers don't have any value anymore anyway. I think that we've all known that after what we've gone through for the last 5 years that the numbers are going to be tainted. They don't have the same value. I very much doubt that most people can even name the top 10 home run hitters in order like we once were able to, or even what the all-time record is held by Barry Bonds. It's a very different time, and I think that's one of the reasons why there's not a great deal of pageantry for this home run chase. I think for the most part, it's all going to be pretty joyless from here on in, numbers-wise at least.
And this plan announced this week for minor league baseball to start testing for human growth hormone. Forgive the analogy, but is that closing the barn door after the horses are out?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think baseball is doing essentially what it felt the public and what the outcry wanted. And I think that the hard part for me actually is that this is something that has to be done. I think it's an extraordinary step. I think that it's a little late in the game, but if you're moving forward, which is what baseball has always said it wanted to do, then this is the next most obvious step because this is the area where you're using drugs that cannot be detected by urine tests. Mm-hmm. The privacy questions, however, if you're a citizen, are a little daunting, considering I don't think I'd want my employer taking blood samples from me, but it's a different industry, and these are very important questions, I think, from a civil liberty standpoint.
And let me ask you about USC, because the athletic director there, Mike Garrett, retired. this week after the scandal that found Reggie Bush and others had been compensated, that means paid, or compensated, gifts and stuff, for playing college football. Pat Caden, Hayden, forgive me, is going to come in to replace Mike Garrett. What does USC do now? I mean, they were used to be one of the great programs.
Sure, and now they're as scandal-ridden as the rest in that dirty game that we call college sports. But I think that one thing USC certainly could do is they could give donate a little bit of the money that Reggie Bush earned for them and that they made off of him instead of giving back the Heisman. Everyone got away, just like they all do when it comes to these sports scandals. The Reggie Bush is a millionaire many times over, and he's with the Saints. Pete Carroll, the coach, he got his millions, and he left before the scandal hit by going to coach. The university got to keep its money. And Reggie Bush is the focal point, and you give back a piece of hardware. But the bottom line is that the university made a lot of money from Reggie Bush and all that was going on. You can't tell me they didn't know anything during.
Let me ask you about Sweet Lou. Lou Piniella announced he is departing at the end of the season as manager of the Chicago Cubs. Now, since Sammy Sosa left the team, there hasn't been a hint of steroid scandal on the Cubs because, as my wife points out, it would be a real scandal if they were taking steroids and losing as much as they do.
Which has been happening.
So is Lou Piniella retiring from baseball, or do you think someone's going to try and bring him back next year?
I think Lou's a lifer, but I think he's had enough. He's had that weary look in his eye for about 7 or 8 years now, and I was surprised that he's lasted this long. It's an end of an era in baseball. Remember when we were all growing up, the manager was the public face of the front office. You had the Lou Piniellas of the world and the Billy Martins and those guys, and now it's very different. And not only that, but Joe Torre turned 70 last weekend, and Bobby Cox of the Braves, he's retiring. So outside of Tony La Russa and maybe, you know, and Dusty Baker, it's a new day. That old-school manager with the chaw in his mouth arguing with the umpire is a thing of the past, and now the general manager is now the public face of pretty much every organization.
Well, some of us still watch Ozzie Guillen, but
Exactly, but Ozzie shares power. Ozzie, and that's pretty much Kenny Williams and Jerry Reinsdorf's team as well. It's a very different game, and I'm going to miss Lou. He was one of my all-time favorites. Every time you see him, you never knew what you were going to get, but it was certainly going to be interesting.
Howard, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The fourth season of Mad Men begins this weekend on AMC. Don Draper and the folks who came over with him from Sterling Cooper after it was inhaled by the British firm Putnam, Powell & Lowe to begin Sterling Cooper Draper at Price will drink martinis at lunch, cold and dry, smoke cigarettes all day, chase scams, and wonder about President Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe. One of the founding documents that inspired the producers to make Mad Men was a 1970 memoir about advertising. From those wonderful folks who gave you Pearl Harbor was Jerry Delafamina's Madison Avenue memoir. His book has just been reissued, and Jerry Delafamina, who still has his own agency and publishes a weekly newspaper and runs a watering hole in East Hampton, joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
You got to explain that title these days.
Well, it was my first day at an agency called Ted Bates, and there I was, and they were talking about the Panasonic account, and they kept saying, we have to do something for the Japanese, we must do something for the Japanese. Big meeting, and I finally said, I've got it. They said, what is it? I said, the headline is, from those wonderful folks who brought you Pearl Harbor. Well, it was the beginning of the end of my career at Ted Bates. I know that people were looking, saying, how did we hire this guy, and how do we get rid of him?
But you write in this book that in other ways, having a reputation for being, you don't say eccentric, you say crazy, was actually professionally helpful.
Oh, it helped a lot because it was a time when people just loved the whole sense of advertising was fun. And I wrote that it was the most fun you can have with your clothes on. And we'll never see it again. And I mean, if I had one martini at lunch today, they would have the EMS truck back up and they would have to take me out. But in those days, a typical lunch, the bartender would be shaking the martinis as we walked in. As we were looking at our menu, the second martini would. And then before the food arrived, the third martini would arrive. At that point, then, we would have two bottles of wine to go with our food. And then invariably, someone, it was never me, but someone would say, no, I don't think I'm going to have dessert. I think I'll have a double scotch instead. And then we went off to work. And I hope the rest of the world was in the same shape we were because we did very well.
You used to run an annual contest that would be unthinkable now.
Oh, my gosh. It would have been a disaster. Literally from when we started the agency in 1967, we had an agency sex contest. And what did that mean? So they would literally get a telephone list, and we're talking about as many as 300 employees, and they would vote for the person they most wanted to go to bed with. And so the two winners, the male winner and the female winner, even though they might not have voted for each other, won a weekend at the Plaza Hotel. It was, quote, our secret, and it was sophomoric, but then we would all gather at a Mexican restaurant and lock the doors. And we would have this wild, wild, wild party where I would then get up there, and after God knows how many margaritas, I would announce the winners, and they would be cheering. And the story I always like to tell was at one point there was an older executive who I think possibly might have imbibed his first taste of cannabis, and he had a lot to drink, and at one point his head went right into his dish. And sitting next to him was this woman who was our research director, and she said, "It's okay, it's okay. He's fine. The guacamole broke his fall." And
sorry. I've been trying to hold myself back and from laughing because I want the record to show I'm appalled by all of this, but the guacamole just, the guacamole line gets me.
Obviously, it was not politically correct, but everyone took part in it. And we were just enjoying doing what we were doing. We were in advertising, and it was fun, and we thought the music would never end.
How's the rise of women in the workplace, not just the ad business, changed advertising?
Oh, it changed it dramatically, and I'm very proud of this. I always had more women working for me than men, more women vice presidents than agencies, three, four times my size. And people ask me, well, why did you hire and have so many women vice presidents? And I said it was just good business for me. If I had a job that I was looking to fill and the salary was $100,000, men, you know, let's face it, if they were getting all the jobs, some of them were really, frankly, overrated. So most likely I would have a man who really was only worth $70,000 looking to get this $100,000 job. Mm-hmm. On the other side, there would be a woman who probably was worth $130,000, but she wanted this job because $100,000 was a lot of money at that time for a woman to be making in the advertising business. Yeah. So women changed this business. They softened it. They made it better.
Hmm. Best ad you ever wrote, the one you did for McGraw-Hill?
Yes, by far.
McGraw-Hill, the old publisher.
The old publisher, and my headline was, "Before Hitler Could Kill 6 Million Jews, He Had to Burn 6 Million Books." And I wrote that headline, and the ad won an award as the best ad of the year. And I have an award at home that I'm very proud of. It says, headline, Jerry Della Femina.
Advertising less dependent on words, now more dependent on images?
It's a different world. It's all about art direction. Words really don't count that much. It's progress. Time goes on. I mean, my very first job was, I got an interview, and I said, "I'll work for nothing." And he said, "No, I have to give you something." And he said, "I'm going to give you $5,200 a year." And he said, "Is that all right?" And I remember biting my lip. I said, "Yeah, yeah." I shook my hand. He said, "I'll see you on Monday." And I walked out, and I got to the ground floor, and I let out the scream. I mean, it was, I could still hear the scream. $5,200 was the most any Della Femina in the history of the Della Feminas had ever been paid. And this was a token salary. I had found my business.
Jerry, very nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
Jerry Della Femina, his memoir From Those Wonderful Folks Who Gave You Pearl Harbor is 40 years old, and it's just been reissued in time for the fourth season of Mad Men. And you can get an even more behind-the-scenes look at the real world of ad men and the ethnic lines that divided the industry at our website, npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Guy Raz is away. I'm Audie Cornish. We begin this hour with a milestone like no other. Earlier this week, someone, somewhere in the world, pulled up a chair to a computer, opened a web browser, and logged on to Facebook for the very first time. That person was the 500 millionth to register on the site. In a moment, a conversation with Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. But first, a little bit about how we got here, how Facebook became a cultural force and changed the way 500 million people communicate. It all started in a dorm room in 2004 as a way to connect with other people at college.
Then, you know, later on in the all-freshman dining hall or one of those super awkward ice cream socials, it might be much easier to start up a conversation.
That is Chris Hughes, a junior at Harvard. He is co-founder of the Getting to Know You website, thefacebook.com. Thefacebook.com started at Harvard only about 7 months ago.
A book of everyone's little mini picture and then like two or three tidbits of information.
It has spread to nearly 70 colleges and universities,
almost
200,000 users.
I like listening to music,
basketball,
board games,
making cool things out of foil.
I don't see people sitting around in dorm rooms and dreaming about being friends with people.
Reports today suggest that Yahoo may be interested in buying Facebook. That's the social networking website. $1 billion with a B dollars.
Well, you know, these social networking sites let people post pictures and create web pages,
talk to each other.
This is a busy time for the social networking business.
Facebook.com.
The average user has 130 friends on the site.
Really, really, genuinely.
The top 10 signs you're obsessed with.
Hate
Facebook.
The social networks are profoundly changing the definition of what we consider private.
Starting today, anybody can join, which has provoked a backlash among some members.
People like exclusivity.
9 million or so people online.
You know, that's not something we're going to talk about.
Facebook, the website, is inviting technology companies and programmers add features to the site.
Only people at your own school or people you know can see it.
They're aiming to overtake MySpace.
Sketchy people can get on it now.
And become the social operating system for the internet.
Its popularity is exploding.
My name is Jillian, and I am a Facebook addict.
300 million active users on Facebook, and about half of them log on in any given day.
And at first, it was really just internet thing, like MySpace, which I never
This
really
is exploding
liked.
So quickly.
Then I realized that it was a whole lot more.
I love how it lets you update your status, like with the most insignificant things you're doing in your life.
I didn't know what Facebook was. And now that I do know what it is, I have to say, it sounds like a huge waste of time.
Facebook.
Facebook.
This week, after just 6 years, the social networking site Facebook reached
500 million.
That's the mind-boggling number of users Facebook hit this week.
500 million.
That's remarkable because the population.
The world without Facebook, I think I would die.
One of the most talked about films of summer has to be Inception. The Leonardo DiCaprio mindbender is all about manipulating people's dreams.
You create the world of the dream. We bring the subject into that dream, and they fill it with their subconscious.
Dreams have always been a handy dramatic device. They allow writers to explore alternate worlds, plots, and what a character is thinking. And here to be our Freudian guide through the world of cinematic dreams is our film critic, Bob Mondello. Hey there, Bob.
Hello. Freudian, I don't know. We'll try.
Well, I saw Inception, and it used dreams in a pretty clever way, sort of layering of dreams. And but it's certainly not a new device. And I hear that you can take us all the way back to the ancient Greeks to talk about this.
Well, I take everything back to the ancient Greeks. They had a word for everything. The earliest dream that I could find in Western drama was in the Persians, a play by Aeschylus. In 472 B.C., so that's pretty far back,
yeah.
The queen in that show dreams of her son's catastrophic military campaign and then discovers to her horror that her dreams were true. And as far as I know, that's the first time that a dream sequence was used in a drama that we still have.
So when did the dream sequence make its way into film?
Oh, I think they got there as soon as filmmakers discovered that by doing a doubled exposure, you could create a ghost. And in 1924, in a silent film, Sherlock Jr., this is my favorite dream sequence ever. Buster Keaton is a movie projectionist, and he falls asleep and dreams that he leaves the projection booth and climbs up on the screen and gets incorporated into the movie. And once he's up there, he's subject to all of the movie grammar, you know, like the quick cuts and the odd camera angles and mirrors that turn into doorways and all these neat cinematic tricks. Basically, Keaton was in an amusing way, teaching the audience about film grammar.
And you can't really talk about dreams in movies, I think, without talking about The Wizard of Oz, which has got to be, you know, one of the more famous dream sequences in film history.
There, lie quiet now. You just had a bad dream.
It's all been a dream, starting with the tornado, basically. Everything that's in color turns out to be Dorothy's dream, but we don't find out about that until the very end.
But it wasn't a dream. It was a place. And you were there.
Oh, sure.
And of course, these days, if you use the whole "it was all a dream" conceit, sometimes that doesn't go over too well.
It doesn't go over too well when they abuse it. Filmmakers and screenwriters sometimes use dream sequences just to get out of problems that they've created for themselves in a script, you know, where it's so complicated that they suddenly realize, oops, that's a dead end for the script. And so they write themselves out of it by just saying, oh, well, it was a character's dream.
Maybe that's why it's so abused in television, where you have this sort of long, you know, periods of character development. So then all of a sudden it maybe feels like a cheat.
Yeah, the classic example of that is Dallas, where at some point they had written themselves so into a corner that they decided the whole eighth season was a dream.
Right.
At that point, the audience sort of rebelled. That it lost a lot of popularity at that point.
Dreams, of course, are such a natural fit for science fiction or better horror films like Nightmare on Elm Street. And I'm thinking of that. You know, you're so vulnerable when you're sleeping.
No, you don't want to fall asleep because Freddy will get you.
We got to stop this.
How?
Don't fall asleep.
Yeah, and science fiction uses it all the time. I mean, The Matrix, the characters were basically doing all of their zipping around through portals and things like that while they were asleep on a slab. In Blade Runner, the title of Philip K. Dick's book that it's based on is Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And Blade Runner actually uses that same notion that Inception does of planting memories that aren't real into somebody's head.
So the challenge for filmmakers is, of course, you know, finding an original take on the dream sequence. And you know, tell me, how do you think that Christopher Nolan, the director of Inception, did?
Well, I don't know that I think it's original exactly, but I think that the things that he did with it, the visualizing of various different levels and things like that, are very clever. There's a sequence in there where there's a I'm hesitant about talking too closely about it because
yes,
a lot
don't
of
give it away.
Right, but there's a trick with mirrors that I thought, you know, as we're looking at this, he's getting at the thing that Buster Keaton did all those years ago, that he's using the movie Dream to illustrate something about cinema, that we're sort of seeing how a special effect gets done.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes more interesting when he starts to play with his own form there.
That's our film critic, Bob Mondello. Thanks, Bob.
It's always a pleasure.
The dream that you wish will come true.